Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, all right, folks, it's about 3:13, so we need to turn to Mark. If my clock is right, it'll be, 4:13 this time next week. Is that correct? Spring forward. 4:13. We're changing divisions in Mark, and we're moving now to the section that, at least in my outline, talks about discipleship, which is really important. And this is, as we were just discussing, one of the things we have omitted is proper teaching and practice of fasting. Discipleship is something that we have also made a mess of, I would argue. So here's our outline for this section. The good news about Jesus' teaching on discipleship. And we begin with the introduction of the healing of the blind man. And in Mark chapter 8, verse 22, this healing of the blind man is one of those miracle stories that is in Mark that is not in any of the other Gospels. And that's kind of unusual because usually if it's in Mark, it's everywhere else. So in Mark chapter 8, verse 22, and they came to Bethesda, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see men, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." All right, so why does Jesus lead this man out of this village, Bethesda, and why does he tell him not to go back into that village? No, well, what's the... Yeah, but what was this village? What was wrong with this village, remember? Well, no, this is one that he... Well, it may be in the same... In an essence, I guess it is. No, but this is one of those places he had done miracles. I think it's in Matthew 11, but I don't remember exactly. And they didn't want him to stay. They asked him to leave, basically, so he left. And he won't go back. And so he's bringing this man out and he's healing him outside the city. And some have said that, the unbelief of that village is why he had to... This is the only instance I know of Jesus needing a do-over. He has to lay hands on this man twice. And so some have said, have argued that it was because of the unbelief of this village that Jesus has to do it twice. But something that's important for us to notice in this story is that the method of Jesus' healing changes. And this is one of those things you and I have difficulty with because we want methodology that we can repeat and reuse over and over and over and not ever have to change anything. And God's ways are always changing to teach us lessons that we'll be dependent on Him and not think that there's some secret in the recipe of the methodology. You know, if I do A, B, C, and D, then X will occur always. Because if that's the case, we take our eyes off of Jesus and put them on the methodology. And that's not the point of the miracle, right? So, I did a little looking in the book, Dr. Wiersbe's book, and this miracle was only found in Mark chapter 8, verse 22-26, and there's another miracle in chapter 7 where he helps a young man hear. Those are the two miracles that are found in Mark's gospel that are not found in any of the other gospels. And that's really unusual. And the reason I have Isaiah 35 and 6, verse 6 up there on the screen with those two miracles is because some say that the reason these two miracles are here is to point people back to this chapter, to point Jewish people back to this chapter. And that's kind of unusual if it's true because Mark is written to Romans, not Jewish people. but that this would point the Jewish people back to this chapter, which was a prophecy of Messiah, and that one of the things about Messiah in verse 6 of chapter 35 of Isaiah is, then shall the lame man leap like a deer, verse 5, not 6, that's a typo, that should be 35 verse 5. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. So it talks about the deaf and the blind. I'm going to go ahead and fix that while I know it's wrong. Oh my goodness. Now, Dr. Wiersbe says that from this story, there are four lessons we should learn. First, that we don't need to seek after signs, but live by faith in His Word. That we should trust Jesus to meet all our needs. And avoid leaven of false doctrine. This is actually what he says about the last section that included chapter 8, verse 22 in his writing. And let Jesus work as He wills and expect variety in His working. And I think that's something we don't like as Baptists. We don't like variety. We want predictability. And there's a big difference. And it's scary to live the Christian life where there's not much predictability. You have to give control to the Lord. And so this was in your book in the section just previous. Now, Dr. Wiersbe also talks about the secrets, that there are secrets that Jesus is revealing, and that some of these are that suffering leads to glory, and we're going to look at that in a minute. And that power comes from faith and service leads to honor. So if you'll, let's go back to Mark chapter 8 now and look at verse 27. And Jesus went on with His disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way He asked His disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told Him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered Him, "You are the Christ." And He strictly charged him not to tell no one about Him. Now, what's that a sign of there, that verse 30? What is that? We've talked about that before. Why would Jesus not want the apostles to tell people who He is if they know? Wasn't that kind of the point of His coming?
And He began to teach him that the Son of Man must suffer many things
and be rejected. Yep. It's not time for all that to happen just yet. So the timing's wrong. But when we think about this, look what Peter responds, "You're the Christ." What does the word Christ mean? Yes, but in the Jewish mind, when somebody says he's the Christ, when Peter says you're the Christ, what's he telling him? Who's he telling him he knows he is? The Son of God, but more precisely in the Jewish mind, Messiah. You're Messiah. You're Messiah. Exactly. Now the suffering, look what Jesus talks about His own suffering. And He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. And He said this plainly. And Peter took Him aside, good old Peter, and began to rebuke Him. Can you imagine the audacity it would take to be rebuking Jesus? Oh, Peter had it. That's one of the reasons why I think he was a Baptist. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." And he said to them, "Truly I say unto you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power." Now, there's a lot in this passage that leads up to the transfiguration. But the things that have to deal with discipleship specifically, let's go back to Jesus confronting Peter and condemning him. What's Peter thinking when he's telling Jesus to not be talking about his death? When he's trying to correct him? Where's that coming from? What's Messiah supposed to do in Peter's understanding before Jesus clarifies his teaching? Right. It would really benefit you to study the New Testament, to go read in the Apocrypha, 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Okay? The apocryphal books, which some Bibles have them in them, the King James Version, you can get it with the Apocrypha or not. It tells you the story of what happened between Malachi and Matthew, this intertestamental period, when there was a great war and rebellion that actually led to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Jesus' ministry is springing up at the end of this time. And in Israel, they were a great group of people who were known as zealots, who some of his disciples were, who wanted to take over and do away with Herod, do away with the Roman occupation, and set up the Jewish state with a king just like it had existed in the time of David. And so for them, Messiah is the one who's going to come lead that. And they're not wrong, they're just, their timing's off. It's turned out to be a few thousand years. So when Peter hears Jesus say, "Who am I am?" And when Peter tells him, "You are the Christ," or "You're the Messiah," his understanding of that is not the suffering servant that Jesus is teaching him about here, that his suffering is what's going to lead to glory. He's thinking of the king that's going to come leading an army, and Peter's going to be his chief of staff, and we're going to go get these Romans. Okay? That's what he's thinking. And so that's what you need to understand, that context, as we go back through this text. When Jesus says to him, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." The things of God are not necessarily the government of the planet at the moment. God has a higher purpose, a greater purpose in the gospel than who's occupying some office. It is the salvation of mankind. And so Peter has totally missed that, as did everyone else. He's just the one that had the gumption to say something. They were all thinking it, I'm sure. And then, so with that in mind, then look at this again. If anyone would come after me, so if you're going to follow me, deny yourself, take up the cross and follow me. Now the cross, we don't truly understand this. Romans would crucify people routinely. Imagine if you were going from here to Emerson today, and between here and there, there would be five or six people on a cross dying. And it was that way every day. Some days more, some days less. And they would just be arbitrarily holes that would have been dug like we have telephone poles. And so when the Roman person, the centurion or whoever is there who has the authority over someone, determines that, hey, I'm going to have to crucify you, they probably make you dig your own hole. And then they nail you to a cross, they put you up, and they go on. I mean, they use this as a means of getting information. You won't tell me the truth. You won't tell me everything you know. You won't tell me who helped you do this. I'll crucify you. So it was just very, very common. And so in their mindset, when they're hearing him take up your cross and follow me, that is just so radical. There's no proper translation between the American experience and what he's saying. Cross, death penalty, electric chair, lethal injection. So he's telling him, you got to give it all up. You're going to die. And so that's what he's. And then he goes on to clarify that. He says, for whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. And aren't we all guilty of trying to save our life? I mean, when we talk about abandoning ourselves before the Lord, living, giving Him everything, aren't we all trying to calculate how much can we hold back? I mean, so, that's what he's saying. And I'm sure none of you sweet ladies have ever played much poker. I financed my first 2 years of college doing things that one shouldn't do, but I was pretty good at it. And there comes a time when you're in a playing poker that you have to go all in. I mean, you can only fool a guy so long. If he's pretty smart, he will pick up on your strategy at some point. And so before he gets there, you need to go all in and get everything he's got. And at some point, for us as a Christian, we've got to go all in. And that's what he's telling us. Lose your life. Forget the consequences. Give me everything. So, and then he asks this question about what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? And boy, that's a great question, isn't it? So, any questions about that before we get to the transfiguration?
So, the Romans were very familiar with that when Jesus was talking about the cross, didn't
they? Yeah, the Jewish people have trouble getting this. Peter did. But the Romans, it would be reading this, who is Mark's audience. Yeah, they're going, whoa, this guy's serious. Yeah, they knew exactly what it was. Yeah, and the idea of cursed be the man who dies upon the tree. The great shame that this would have brought. And we get some of that as we read on in the Gospels after the resurrection, or the road to Emmaus, how dejected these guys are because their Savior, they thought, has now been crucified by the Romans. So they're literally thinking everything they believed was wrong. So they're going along the road just, you know, terribly distraught. And we don't get that fully because we have been in some manner improperly taught that it's just Jesus that died on the cross. And then it goes from being a sign of contempt to being a sign of salvation. So that shows you a lot of thinking that was changed. But for this time, the audience that would be reading the Romans, they would have gotten it completely. Excellent point. Well, let's go to the Transfiguration. This is a truly amazing story that we don't talk enough about, don't preach enough about, the Transfiguration.
Don't you understand
Yeah, please.
You just said what can a man give in return for his life? Somebody if he was the prophet of man to gain the whole world
and lose his own soul.
Anyway, they found Charlemagne.
Charlemagne, yeah, the king.
They found his tomb, and when they went in, they had all these treasures around the throne, and Charlemagne was sitting on the throne, of course, just his bones, had an open Bible in his lap, and his finger was pointing to this verse.
Wow.
I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, well, I wonder if hopefully Charlemagne was making that a point of irony, knowing that he had not trusted those things, but it could be a great, that the joke's on him. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting, Lee. Sure is. Charlemagne was, I think, one of the so-called Holy Roman Emperors. Yeah, but he also, I think, had the additional title of the Holy Roman Emperor, yeah. Verse 2 of chapter 9. And after 6 days, Jesus took him, Peter, and James and John, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to him Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make 3 tents or tabernacles or booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And notice, he didn't know what to say, but that didn't stop him from talking. Therefore, once more I have the evidence that Peter was a Baptist. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud. This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. Yeah, can you imagine? If he was terrified before that, I bet he's really shaking in his shoes now. And suddenly looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So here, once more, we see that idea of the messianic secret that we saw at the end of verse 30. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things, and how it is written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt. But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him. So, this transfiguration, this is a glorification event. God is showing that Jesus is unique. And if you were a Jewish person, your all-time stars of the Old Testament would be who? Moses and Elijah. There are 3 groupings of miracles in the Bible. There are the miracles that occur in Moses around the Exodus. There are the miracles that occur in Kings around Elijah and Elisha. And then there are the miracles that occur in the life of Jesus and the early church. That's it. So by having Moses and Elijah appear with him and saying to Peter and to James and to John, these Jewish people, these are great guys, but this one's better. Hear him. This is my beloved Son. So the transfiguration event tells us, Mark is showing us that Jesus is the Son of God, as I told you in the very first verse at the end. And so we got kind of here in the middle of the book, he's really showing him that he's the Son of God. Not telling us, now he's showing us. So the transfiguration is really for all the people from Missouri. You know, the show me state. Don't tell me, show me. Well, in the transfiguration, I mean, that's what God is showing us. Jesus is his son. But it also shows a lot about Peter and about people and about our ideas of religion and how messed up they are when it comes to truly pleasing God. Building three monuments, God's not interested in that. His interest is, this is my beloved son, listen to him, obey him. So that's where we miss it. Right.
And, set up the kingdom of God right there on the spot.
Right.
And then also Moses and Elijah is the illustration of the two ways into heaven. Die naturally or you're transfigured.
Yep.
And of course we'll all be transfigured that are alive on earth and eternal.
Right. And there are also evidence there of Moses was the prophet, as was Elijah, but the prophet gives us the law, Moses does, but Elijah shows you the Spirit. Because, you know, here the thing that he leaves Elisha is that mantle of the Spirit. That's where we get the idea of passing the mantle to someone. Yeah, Elijah is a fascinating figure of history and in the Scripture. That would be a great study, just to figure out the prophet Elisha and look at all the things he did. Because he does things that Moses didn't do. I don't think there's an evidence of Moses raising anyone from the dead. I don't remember that. But there is Elijah, does that? As does Elisha. So you see Jesus doing some of the miracles Jesus does points us back to Elijah. Some of the miracles Jesus does points you back to Moses. But Elijah is really a fascinating figure. But well, he had a staff that did a lot of miracles, yeah. But the miracles occurred, yes, he did.
But you really see more of God working through him.
Right. But remember, he did have the power of God and he did misuse it. And that's why he didn't get to go. So he was performing miracles. He hit that rock to show himself to be mighty. And that's what got him in trouble. So yeah, he did have that power. But look if you will now, this idea of being risen from the dead in verse 9. And he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had been risen from the dead. Verse 10, so they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. So they still don't get it.
Never did get it.
That's right. They are very thick. That's why I think they're Baptist. No, they didn't get it until Pentecost. They didn't get it until God gave it to them. And that's a wonderful illustration for us, because we can't get it with our natural mind. You can't naturally contemplate these things. They have to be spiritually discerned. Preachers have sugar stick sermons that they preach at, you know, conferences of other preachers. And mine is entitled, How to Soar Like an Eagle When You're Surrounded by a Bunch of Turkeys. And it's about the disciples. Because if you go and you look at all these different texts, I mean, we truly have the gang that cannot shoot straight here. And it's only through the power of the risen Lord and His Spirit that they could do anything. And that's why I think it's amazing that we get that idea that we are something and that God's lucky to have us. And it really messes us up, because we truly are just like them. It's real easy to look at it from our perspective in history and go, why couldn't they see that? But we're just as bad. Probably worse. Right. Well, you look at it with hindsight. Yeah. Yeah. Now, this story, this next story, the healing of the boy with the unclean spirit. So imagine how Jesus must have felt. The transfiguration has got to be a high point for anybody. I mean, this has got to be high, high, high. And so he goes from that, he goes down the mountain, and then he walks up on this. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And here's that word again. And immediately, all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." So clearly Jesus is not pleased with his disciples. They would flunk their annual evaluation. So they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, here's that word again, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And I love this next verse because it shows us something that we need to be mindful of. And Jesus said to him, "If you can..." Yeah, if I can, I mean, do you see that contempt Jesus is giving him? "All things are possible for one who believes." And then this is a wonderful, wonderful prayer we need to all pray. In the next verse, "Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, 'I believe, help my unbelief.'" And that is a absolutely valid prayer that each of us can and should pray. There's nothing wrong. When you are doubting, don't be an American and fake it till you make it. Be a Christian and pray this prayer. "I believe, help my unbelief." It is absolutely essential that we understand that it is always proper to pray this prayer. And somehow we've gotten in our idea that, oh, well, that's, I don't want to admit that. I don't want folks to think, what would somebody say? Well, that's just, you know, balderdash. So, go ahead. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's no problem with him. It's all on you. So verse 25, "And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him.'" And then look at this next part. "And never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, 'He is dead.' But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, 'Why could we not cast it out?'" That's the great question of this story for us. And he said, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer and fasting." And that's a great issue for us, because I believe... Martin Lloyd-Jones was a pastor in England in the 50s, 40s and 50s and 60s. And Dr. Jones said that you and I need to understand that we are up against a different kind of spirit today. And so you think about it, these disciples, they had been successful against demons. Because remember, he sent out the 12. They came back rejoicing that even the demons were subject to them. He sent out another 70. They come back rejoicing that even the demons are subject to them. But not this kind. And so Jesus is clearly teaching us that this is a different kind of powerful entity than the other kind that they have been casting out. And so, if you will, take your Bible real quick and let's flip over to Ephesians chapter 6 to see what the Bible teaches us about this. Verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Now, I cannot explain to you what each of those different divisions mean exactly. And I would kind of be suspicious of anybody who said they could. But that text does show us that there are different divisions of these spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. We are battling against rulers. We are battling against authorities. We are battling against cosmic powers of this present darkness. And so there is these different levels, different divisions, whatever you want to call them, of spiritual wicked forces that are arrayed against God's people. And so when Jesus is saying this kind, he's got to be alluding to something like that. So maybe in America as the, and this is always strange, and you probably know this because you've had a lot of missionaries come in and through your churches, and you probably know a lot of missionaries personally. They'll tell you that when they go on the foreign mission field, there are different things that from our perspective are weird that happen on the foreign mission field that we've never seen happen here. And I think the reason for that is the Christian church has been and historically been weaker in places like Africa and the Far East than it was in America or in Western Europe. And as a result of that strength in numbers of the Christian church, we didn't have those kinds of evil forces to contend with.
Now are scaring
the, oh, not just scaring them, they're killing them. In Nigeria, right now, there's a purge going on, and two out of every three converts to Christianity are killed. Yet there's still a revival going on. And if you want to know a little bit about what's happening in the world, you need to Google. Go to Voice of the Martyrs. Just put that in, Voice of the Martyrs. And it's an organization, a worldwide organization, that gives you information about persecution in the world of the Christian church. Voice of the Martyrs. But this idea of these different entities, so I think as the Christian church decreases in America, these different forces that we maybe did not have to fight in the past are going to gain, and we're going to have to fight them. And so for us to be successful, we're going to have to do what Jesus says here and pray and fast in a way we haven't been praying and fasting.
And mine says to pray and fast.
Yeah. Yes. Fast and pray. Pray and fast and pray. We need to do that as a people. Yes, casseroles need not be the Baptist call sign. Yeah. Yeah, just this month. You're just naming the things this month. Yeah. Well, it's almost true. It's not completely true, but it's almost true that every time we meet, we eat. And maybe we need to think about that. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Our Southern hospitality is contrary to our Christian vitality. And we need to think about that. Yeah. We have cottage prayer meetings. And I've tried to make it clear to all the folks, we're not coming to your house to inspect. We're not coming to your house to eat. And I've yet to have one that we didn't have something served. Last night we had chili at the Bergrams. So, you know, I guess Pam and I are going to have to host one and have people come and not serve them anything. Good. Okay, thank you. I'm...
I can't wait
to
come back and tell me if
she did. Well, here's the problem. There are a lot of folks that I would rather wouldn't serve anything than Madge. I'm just being honest. Now in verse 30, so here in chapter 9, Jesus is talking about his death twice. So look at verse 30. And give me a time check. What time is it? Okay, so we got time to do this. They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise." But they did not understand the saying and were afraid to ask him. Isn't that just like us? I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm afraid to ask. I don't want nobody to think I don't know. I think everybody else. All these other 11 other guys know what he's talking about, and I'm the only one that doesn't know.
This is the second time that he has said this in this chapter.
Yes. Yeah.
Until the Son of Man is rose from the dead. And they seized upon that statement, discussing with one another, that they wouldn't ask him.
Right. And you know, it's easy to sit here in this far from the event and condemn them for being so stupid they didn't go ask him, because nobody else knows what he knows. But I'm sure if we were in the same situation, we would have done the same thing. Verse 9 tells you, but also look at what we've covered today, which started in chapter 8, in verse 30 of chapter 8, and then in verse 9 of chapter 9, and now again in verse 30 of chapter 9, three times we have this idea of Jesus telling them not to tell anybody what they know about him, or this messianic secret. So it's occurred now three times in just these short few passages. So next week, we're going to we'll start right there at verse 33, which once more is a great opportunity for the disciples to shine as they argue over who's the greatest. And we will proceed from there into chapter 10 and Jesus' teaching on divorce. Anybody have any questions or comments? Mark chapter 9, verse 32, I think, is where we'll start next time.
Is it Matthew or?
Mark, the Gospel of Mark. Yeah. All right.